Hello and welcome to The Libertarian, a production of Defining Ideas for the Hoover Institution. I'm your host, Troy Sennick, joined today, as always, by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, the Peter and Kirsten Bedford Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, Professor of Law at the NYU School of Law, and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, the Supreme Court and voting rights. All right, Richard. Well, earlier today, you had the Supreme Court handing down their decision in Shelby County v. Holder. This is a case dealing with the 1965 Voting Rights Act, and specifically the topic of preclearance, of certain jurisdictions having to receive approval from the federal government anytime they make even the slightest alterations to their voting practices. So before we get into the ruling, why don't you walk us through the basics of how the Voting Rights Act changed the traditional distribution of power when it comes to conducting elections and setting policy, and how it relates to the 15th Amendment.
Fine. Well, I think we should start with the text of the 15th Amendment, both clauses of which really matter. And clause number one says, "The right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude." Section two, "The Congress shall have the power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation." It's very clear if you start looking at the first clause, when they refer to citizens, they really mean all citizens, those people who were defined as citizens in the 14th Amendment, overruling Dred Scott. And therefore, in effect, you cannot use race as a ground or as a proxy in any way, shape, or form to block voting. And it's also clear that Congress has a lot of authority to deal with this by appropriate legislation. From the period between 1865 and perhaps all the way through Brown v. Board of Education, maybe even later, it's pretty clear that in large portions of the United States, the 15th Amendment was the dead letter. The Congress didn't do much to enforce anything, and the courts did very little to enforce things on their own initiative. And so what you did is you had, as is well documented in these cases, systematic exclusion of African Americans from the polls in both state and federal elections. In Mississippi, for example, I think the number was about 6% of blacks who were able to vote, as opposed to about 70% of whites. The 1965 Civil Rights Act was very tough medicine on that. And what it did is it devised two devices in order to handle the problem. One of them in Section 2 is allows for case-by-case challenges through the Justice Departments of the states to make sure that any kind of proposals, or rather individual citizens, that don't meet the substantive standards set out in the 15th Amendment can be challenged and struck down. And that was slow, tedious, a lot of resistance from state governments. So in 1965, Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act essentially says, look, it's going to work the other way. If you guys want to introduce any change in these key states, mainly southern states, what you have to do is to get preclearance from the United States Attorney General or from some federal district court. And before you get that, nothing whatsoever can be done. Now, the question is, which states trigger this particular obligation? And those were defined in the 1964 Act to cover states in which there was very low turnout in presidential elections and so forth. And so what happens is that statute gets renewed several times for short periods until, I think, it's about 1980 or 81. It gets renewed for 25 years. And then again in 2006, it gets renewed for another 25 years. So we have the following very deep irony. In the early years where there was massive abuse, you had relatively short time frames for the statutes and powers which were substantial. But ironically, as the situation gets better, the remedial intervention becomes more draconian. The period in which the statute is now to take place is 25 years. It's not 5 years. And it turns out that the weapons that are given to the federal government to deal with this are more extensive than those you had in 1965. And so the best question that we had to ask is the relationship between means and ends. Is the situation with racial voting in the United States so parlous today that this extension is to be justified, or is the fact the mismatch between remedy on the one hand and violations on the other so grotesque that the amendment itself turns out to be, ironically, a violation of the equal protection of laws in the sense that it subjects citizens of one state to a series of federal oversights which citizens of other states, which are equal sovereigns within the union, do not have to face.
So that gets us up to about the present. A few years ago, 2009, I believe, the Supreme Court got a challenge, which they resolved on the statutory grounds in the Northwest Austin case. But they hint at that point that they have serious misgivings about the law, which opens the door for Shelby County, Alabama, which brought this case. Break down for us the argument of the jurisdictions like Shelby County that have fallen under Section 5 of the VRA and why they were pushing back against the Justice Department here.
Well, I think, oddly enough, if you look at the record of the Shelby County case, it's a factless record. And I discovered just reviewing the opinion, the reason is that Shelby County sort of brought a preemptive action against the United States government saying, this has gone too far. We just want to get rid of this entire system. And there was no particular dispute around which to show whether or not it was a wise or foolish kind of decision. If you go back to the Northwest Austin case, it's pretty clear there's something very foolish that's going on. This is a utility district, which wasn't even in existence at the time of the 1965 Act. There is no hint anywhere in any way, shape, or form that there's any racial issue that's involved in the way in which the utility board operates or any particular dislocation by way of race with respect to people who are eligible to participate. So you can find a better set of facts for somebody who wants to show the mismatch. And what the Supreme Court said is, you know, this looks really bad to us. We've got this little statutory out. But if there's no statutory out, then, you know, we're going to have to face it head up. And since there's no statutory scheme involved in the situation in Shelby County, everybody conceded that what you had to do was to face the constitutional issue. And so there it sits.
So let's talk about how they did that. The majority in this case, which was the five Republican appointees on the court, did something interesting. They did not overturn Section 5, but they did overturn Section 4B, which was the basis for the current formula the federal government's been using determine which jurisdictions had to submit to preclearance. So tell us how they got there and what that means going forward and what your reaction to that opinion.
Yeah, well, I mean, there were on the Section 5 question, there was a kind of a concurrence by Justice Thomas said, look, the whole thing is completely rotten and we have to get rid of it today. But Justice Roberts regards himself as something more of an incrementalist. And the position that he took with respect to this issue was quite simply, look, we can strike down Section 4 and all of the efforts to refer back the pattern of discrimination to 50 years ago. And Congress, somebody could come up with a different scheme that could be put into place and that scheme would no longer be so invidious. Now, it turns out, of course, everybody considered this back in 2006. But if you don't stick with the tried and true villains in this particular piece, it turns out it's virtually impossible for anybody to get consensus on what the new test should be. If you actually look at the patterns of voting, many of the states which are subject to preclearance regimes have overall participation levels on the part of many black citizens, which are higher than those of white. But the debate, Justice Thomas basically believes that the whole preclearance study is so utterly grotesque that the whole thing should be struck down. And that's a fairly dramatic type situation. The other four are a little bit more tepid on this, and they're willing to think that you may be able to find another way to tweak the criteria that trigger preclearance in a way that doesn't force you back to dealing with 1964 realities in 2013. The difficulty that experiences when you have the rehearings in 2006 is nobody knows what the new criteria ought to be. And so even if everybody agreed that the old criteria were bad, the kind of the, shall we say, the tyranny of the status quo influenced them very heavily. Now it's going to be thrown back into the lap of Congress, and they're going to have to decide whether they're going to do something about it. And if they do, it's going to be hard for them to figure out what to do, because as a general matter, what our friend Justice Roberts points out is that overall levels of participation by blacks in southern states subject to the preclearance are at least as good, maybe a tad better than they are elsewhere in the country. So if you're trying to figure out whether there's any micro evidence or macro evidence of serious abuse, you just can't find it in the situation today. Now, the dissent agrees that there's been enormous progress in this situation, but it insists that there's further to go. And here they put it basically in two forms. One is they say you need Section 5 preclearance to stop backsliding. People might now decide to return to the old patterns. I regard that as largely preposterous. Given the huge change in the electorate, it's not as though you're going to have to deal with Theodore Bilbo in Mississippi going forward. And they also talk about the so-called secondary effects, by which they mean the way in which you structure and organize the districts may in fact give some benefit or some detriment to minority citizens in various areas. They were not worried about secondary effects since 1964. They were worried about lynching, throwing people out from the polls, white primaries, and the whole thing. And all of these issues, you don't even know which way they cut. So I regard those two arguments as being extraordinarily weak in terms of the, what's going forward. And therefore, in this particular case, I think I would have voted with the majority. I mean, I know I would.
So give me a sense of the sort of the tangible takeaway here. I mean, what does the playing field look like from here? Give us an idea of what changes and what perhaps remains ambiguous going forward based on this decision.
Well, I think, in effect, going forward, the first response is going to be political recriminations. It's quite clear that this is a decision which is a flashpoint for left and right, much like the affirmative action cases turn out to be. And it's also clear that the five-member majority included Justice Anthony Kennedy, who was silent, that is, he did not speak in this case. And I think he's always the one member of the court that the liberals and the civil libertarians believe they can woo away from the conservative majority and get to go the other way. And there was no sign of any defection in this case. And indeed, if you go look at the recent term, there are two employment discrimination cases. There's a real estate land case of one kind or another. All of them have 5-4 decisions with Kennedy solid in the majority. So the 5-4 split, I think, is becoming stronger, which, of course, is going to create a lot of political pressures about new appointments to the Supreme Court. Will Justice Ginsburg resign at the end of the term so that the Democrats can appoint somebody who's a little bit younger, so they don't have to worry about the risk of a change in power at the election of 2016 and so forth. So there'll be all of those kinds of issues that they'll have to be facing. There's also, of course, going to be the question of what's to be done next. It's obviously that nothing more is to be done before the Supreme Court. Congress still has some play in the joints, according to Justice Roberts' decision. He certainly doesn't think that discrimination allowing people to vote is anything other than abhorrent. But they have to come up with a remedy. And remember, you've got at least a blocking position in the Senate, and you have a Republican majority in the House. And so if the burden of going forward is going to be on the defenders of the Voting Rights Act, they're going to have a very hard road to play. And I think it's quite likely that, at least for the foreseeable future, that we will be rid of all of these preclearance positions, for better or worse. Now, Justice Ginsburg, I mean, in many ways, the most interesting part of her opinion is she starts to go in great detail to some particular instances where there were various kinds of abuses for which she said that the individualized relief is too slow. And, you know, you can probably point out 10 or 15 of those over the last 20 years. And perhaps she's even right about the merits, which I have no comment on. But this is my reaction. Once you get rid of preclearance, and the government is still determined to have an aggressive voice in civil rights issues, the pace by which those cases will be brought will be ferocious. And that whatever you think was the situation back in 1985 in the years of Reagan will not be the situation in 2014 in the years of Obama, and if he's still around, Mr. Holder. So I do think, in effect, that one consequence is that we may see more Section 2 stuff than Section 5 stuff, but I think they're going to find it very difficult to win on the Section 2 stuff because I just don't think there are that many violations that are around. Here's one very simple test. Take the Northwest Austin case and ask yourself whether there's any conceivable Section 2 challenge to the composition and organization of that water utility board. And the answer to that question is not a prayer. You can't even get yourself within 1,000 miles of that particular case. So in many ways, I think what's going to happen is there'll be a lot of huffing and puffing, but I don't think that we will see a lot more of this stuff. It may well be, I sort of end up this section, is that from 1965 to 2013, we had 48 years, but now we may well have come to the end of an era.
Final question. There is an argument that the dissent sort of anticipates, and which you know will be taken up in the media, as it always is in decisions like this, where people will say, you conservatives are supposed to love judicial restraint. Here you've got a law that was passed by overwhelming majorities of Congress, and it was reauthorized by them time and time again. No real controversy on this on the legislative side. And then the Supreme Court comes in and Bigfoots the whole thing. So why is this not an undue intrusion from the judicial branch on what ought rightly to be legislative territory?
The argument about judicial restraint, Troy, is always a two-edged sword. because now the conservatives could come around and they can say, you guys in the Warren Court were always willing to strike down legislative excesses, even if they were supported by dominant majorities. After all, in 1964, nobody thought that there was a political majority in favor of getting rid of segregation in the South. And bold and true as we were, we did it. So in some cases, it turns out that being passive is a mistake. In some cases, it turns out being active is a mistake. But simply to use the label on either side is, I think, a completely misguided sort of argument. What you have to do is to go down and ask yourself a very simple question. Is this a particularly appropriate form of legislation to deal with the kind of abuse that was found in the 15th Amendment? And the answer, as far as I can see, is that it is not. It's just wildly over-inclusive on the one hand, and there are very few real issues to deal with on the other. Well, to put it in another way, is what was appropriate, and I think Chief Justice Roberts was right about this, what was appropriate in 1965 to deal with the calamitous situation in the South is no longer appropriate today, and you have to be blind to all realities. One of the sad things about this is that many people in the civil rights movement desperately want to keep this particular flame burning, because the more they can say, aha, look at the fact that Congress has found these massive injustices, the more it gives them a civil rights club that they can use in all sorts of other debates. And I think in this particular case, it's not warranted. What we really ought to do is to celebrate the fact that we've gone so far in a relatively short period of time to eliminate what was one of the true cancers in the United States. And sometimes we have to celebrate our victories and not pretend that the road ahead is almost as long as the road behind. I think it is simply a matter of ignoring history. And I'm old enough to actually remember the debates over the 64 and 65 Civil Rights Act to think that there's anything about contemporary America which bears any relationship to what went on in the United States in those eras. I just cannot even begin to imagine how you could think of any constellation of political forces in the United States which would seek to impose even 1/1,000,000th of the kinds of restrictions that were routine business in many places in the United States in the South and in some places in the North beforehand. We've made some progress on those things, and sometimes what you should do is to congratulate yourself and then move on to other problems. And believe me, in this country today, maybe not on matters of race, but on other issues, we have serious questions. Or to quote, there's this famous line, you know, I think it's from Du Bois, W.B. Du Bois, he said in 1901, he says, the color line is the great problem of the next century. I don't think that would be true in 2001.
Richard Epstein, thank you as always. A reminder to our listeners, you can find Richard's weekly column, The Libertarian, by going to hoover.org and clicking on Defining Ideas. And you can follow Richard on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. For the Hoover Institution, I'm Troy Sinek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. Thank you for listening.